Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and today we are going to be talking with attorney Peter Lowe. He's a favorite here on the HR Power Hour, and as a matter of fact, was our first guest. He is an attorney, an employment attorney at Brown and Isaacson in Lewiston, Maine. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, David. It's good to be back again.
Yeah, no, we're excited to have you on the phone. I know today we have you a little bit on your cell phone, and I hope everybody will bear with us a little bit with the background noise, but I know it will be well worth today's time. We have a heck of a topic today. We're going to be talking about doing an investigation the right way, how to handle it. Peter, why would an organization really have to go out and think about investigating things and kind of give an overview of what you think an organization would be seriously having to look into in that type of manner?
Well, you know, as part of my practice, I work with a lot of employers, both in the private sector and also in the public sector, government agencies, school departments, municipalities. And frankly, regrettably for them, there's a host of issues that need to be investigated. And if you take the issues that can be probably most troubling and litigious in our employment world, and you start thinking of matters of harassment, of discrimination, a threat of violence, even, unfortunately, an act of violence, drug issues, alcohol issues, theft, embezzlement, you know, the list goes on, Dave. And all of those issues, if they are to be addressed and are having an impact on your workplace, your business, your bottom line, your employee morale, the welfare and safety of employees, are going to require some degree of investigation, some more than others. So, you know, that's the context in which it's set. I just routinely deal with employment clients, and invariably I'm talking to them about either whether they should investigate or how to investigate. So it's a daily topic for me, I'd say.
Well, you know, just to set the stage a little bit more, if I could, because I think one of the things that you stated right at the end there was when to investigate. And so before we get into how to handle the complaint and all that sort of stuff that we're really going to get into the meat of today, which is the critical part, I'd like to know what your thoughts are when an organization really says, is this worth investigating? When should I do so? And then we can get into the mechanics of how.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because one of the number one issues I see in terms of exposure that organizations have and employers in particular have is their failure to investigate. And there's a whole host of reasons, and we maybe can get to that in a minute, about, you know, why do employers sometimes duck, if you like, or put their head in the sand or avoid doing an investigation. I try to make this as simple as possible, and so I've sort of reduced it to a list in my mind of the times when an employer should be saying to his or herself, when are we going to do it? When are we going to gather the facts? If the allegation is that somebody has engaged in illegal conduct, one of your employees has engaged in some illegal conduct, and there is an impact on the workplace, it's a broader topic, but it may not necessarily just be illegal conduct within the office or during work. It may go beyond that, and that's devil in the details stuff. But illegal conduct's one thing that stands out for me. Another one, it's a broad description, but is there a risk of harm by what has been alleged? Safety issue, someone might get hurt. A bullying issue, someone's going to certainly be emotionally hurt by that conduct. Those are other issues where, yes, if this is true, and that's always a big if, there's a risk of harm to either an employee, maybe a customer, maybe a contractor, maybe to property, maybe to financial resources. That's to be investigating. There are some circumstances where employers are required by law to investigate. And one of the times, plainly, is when you're dealing with harassment and discrimination issues. I'm on the cell phone today, but I just stepped out of a conference here in Augusta where I've been presenting, in fact, on this topic to the Maine school boards. And their issues are issues of for example, if there's an allegation of abuse, plainly there's a need to investigate. If there's an allegation of bullying, that is now mandated for investigation by schools. And finally, you must investigate as an employer if your policy says so. Sounds obvious, but folks overlook that. You know, they have all these policies. We used to say they gather dust, but now they gather whatever the equivalent is online of dust. But policies get drafted, everyone focuses on them, and then they kind of get shelved. And I'll get a client call and say, yeah, this person's alleging that they're being treated differently because of their age. I don't think it's true. Do I have to do anything? And I say, well, yes, you do. That's a claim of discrimination. Whether or not you believe it to be true really isn't germane until you've investigated. And I bet you your policy on non-discrimination says, if you make a complaint, we will investigate. You don't later want to be in court or before the Maine Human Rights Commission and someone points out you didn't follow your policy. That's a bad start. You know, finally, it's when your gut tells you to investigate. And I'm a believer in gut being instinct, judgment. Dave, you've been in a situation. You feel that, like a little pit in the stomach. You know something's not quite right. And maybe one voice on one shoulder says, geez, let's not rock the boat. But the other one says, we should be doing something. Really listen to that gut, that instinct.
No, you're absolutely right. There is no question that over the years, I think all of us, listeners out there, as well as myself, have had those moments where we go, something's just not right. And you do need to look into it. You know, one of the things you brought up and you talked about is the failure to investigate. And you were on our show last year and you talked about Penn State. And Penn State is the classic example in terms of not doing it the right way when it comes to investigation, when it comes to how it's handled. But, you know, that the examples that I know from what, you know, we've had discussions before, the top person, the top dog, for example, is someone who may not be someone that somebody's concerned about investigating, the risk of reputational harm, the highly regarded, you know, respondent who really is someone who's very highly regarded in the organization, maybe the top salesperson, you know, someone who is the bottom of the run, you know, somebody who not as highly regarded, you know, hey, it's not nothing any criminal, it's nothing that we really have to look into, it's not my business. And then the last thing, of course, in this case, why don't people fail to investigate? Well, it's because they hope it blows over. You mentioned that a little bit. Take a little bit of that just for a couple seconds, and then we'll get into the meat of it. But those are the things that certainly I think you and I would agree are the top reasons that people don't investigate.
You're right on that. When I present on this topic, I'll say to them, have you ever found yourself in the situation where someone higher up than you and pretty high up in the company is alleged to have done something that violates policy, at least? It may be the big, big rainmaker. It may be the owner or the owner's son. It may be the CEO, CFO, somebody high up. So the people in the audience, you just see, that resonates. You know, at times they look like they're asleep when I'm talking to them, but on this occasion, they're suddenly nodding their heads. And I said to them, God, you know, I sympathize, empathize, you're in such a tough situation there because of the dynamics that are going on within the organization. The times where an investigation doesn't occur because of that person's elevated status, because they're a top dog, is the term you used. And don't get me started, but that's very much what happened in Penn State, and anybody who's followed it has, you know, seen the tragedy that unfolded. And the people at the top are now in considerable peril and under indictment. But it was that unwillingness early on to sort of take on people who are perceived to be in a more powerful position. And a bunch of other factors. But, you know, that is a particular challenge. And sometimes an HR person, when that comes up, you know, may be better off to look outside, to look at other resources. It may be bigger than, you know, the organization can handle internally, but ignore those at your peril. They're the ones that come back and bite you, unfortunately, and be very careful. The failure to investigate is the organization's, you know, worst moment. All bad things are going to happen to pretty much any organization at some point, some worse than others. However, if you deal with it, you deal with it on a timely basis, you're going to be much better off. But if you are deceived to tolerate it, look the other way, not take action, then that becomes, you know, an institutional failure of immense gravity.
So we're going to talk about how to handle the complaint. I think, you know, now that we've established that it's happened, somebody's come forward, you know, somebody's made an allegation of some sort, no matter what it is, we can pick many examples. So somebody's come forward, how should a HR professional, an owner, if it's a smaller organization, or a business partner, really look at what to do first?
You know, the good news is, frankly, that someone's come forward. That may sound odd. You've got a complaint. That's never good news. I view it that you want to know about it, and it's not necessarily all true or accurate. However, you're now on notice, and you have some obligation. And that very first connection, when the person comes forward, or someone else comes forward on their behalf, and we all know that happens a lot. One coworker speaks to another saying, you know, I think Jimmy is harassing me, but doesn't want to bring it forward. So the very first step of an investigation will usually involve, you know, the intake, the complaint coming in, sometimes in writing, but more often than not through a sit down face to face with the person who's got the issue. And I think that that's a crucial part of any investigation, and I have some tips on that. I think right away the HR person wants to express appreciation for the person coming forward. That's different from saying, you know, you're right, we believe you, we don't believe you. It's way too early for that. Most people don't want to come forward. It's really difficult to come forward, especially about these sensitive issues like harassment or discrimination. Let's focus on harassment.
Sure, sure.
Something to take quite a bit. So I think you've got to immediately express that appreciation. You've got to make the person understand what the process will be. And you walk them through, and you give them some expectations as well about this is the timetable, this is how long it's going to take. It will almost always take longer than you think. Don't be too ambitious to say, this, I'll wrap this up by the end of the week and it's Wednesday. Probably not going to happen. But I compare this to, you know, when you fly on an airline and the airline tells you, we're going to be a little bit delayed and this is why we're going to be delayed. That's the sort of thing you want to do when you're communicating with people in this situation. These investigations take time. You're way more tolerant if you learn what's going on. So you say to the person who's come forward, actually, it's taking a little longer. It won't be until next week now. Keep them plugged in. I work with some companies that have their own internal investigators. And, you know, frankly, this is not my wisdom. It's their wisdom, and I'm sharing it with you. The investigators have told me is establishing and keeping the connection with the person who's come forward. The connection is crucial. A couple of other issues, and I'll do this at a high level because I know this is you know, there's more to this whole topic, but you've got often people come forward and they say, you know, I want to tell you, but this shouldn't go any further. Have you heard that one?
Oh, many times, many
times.
Yeah,
like, this is between you and I. Just give you a heads up. I don't want anything to happen to him. Those are common refrains. And understandable ones. I make no judgment about people saying those. I completely understand. The reality is you can't make those promises. In fact, if you do make those promises, you're falling into a trap. So you have to explain confidentiality, and you have to say, look, you know, it becomes my responsibility. Now you've brought this to my attention. do investigate it, I will be as respectful as I can be about your confidentiality, but I'm going to have to talk to the person you're complaining about, and just by the nature of my questions, it's likely he will connect the dots and realize that we've spoken. So you've got to be truthful in that sense. You've got to manage expectations, and you have to do that. It's a challenging part of the process, and that's why establishing the connection throughout and saying, look, if that's troubling you, if you're having difficulty, if you think you're being retaliated against, you know, I'm your connection, here to help you, stay in touch with me, we can support you, all really important. You don't want the person who comes forward to feel that they're now in this sort of adversarial interrogation because they'll clam up. You won't get the information you need, and you'll create, you know, the wrong atmosphere.
And you're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're speaking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney for Brown and Isaacson, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And this show is presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are talking to Peter Lowe, employment attorney for Brown and Isaacson, and we're talking about investigations. And right now we're talking about how to handle them. Peter, you've provided in the first segment a really good overview of why it happens and kind of what to expect when that complaint comes in. Now let's talk about once the complaint comes in, the person has kind of provided the information to the HR person or the business leader or whoever it is, the manager that they're talking to. They provided that something has happened. The HR person or the business advisor has told them, hey, thank you for bringing that information forward. We're going to go through this process in terms of making sure it happens. What's the next step?
Well, one thing that usually has to be considered at this point, and let's keep the theme of a harassment complaint. So let's say it's a sexual harassment complaint. A female person who's alleging harassment, male coworker allegedly engaging in it. One of the threshold questions that any professional has at that point is, do I put anybody out of work? Us lawyers like to call that administrative leave. Some people inadvertently call it a suspension. If you're listening today, and one thing to take away, eradicate that word suspension from your lexicon when you're dealing with these issues. Suspension is a discipline. Administrative leave is based on no judgment, no conclusion being reached, innocent until proven guilty. And your company may have a policy on it. If you have a union, it may be an collective bargaining agreement. But you need to determine whether both of these people, the person making the accusation and the accused, can continue to work together. So that's a big call that you need to make early on.
Now, Peter, just to jump on that for just a second, sometimes it's not necessarily administrative leave. They may have multiple locations. Could they be brought to a different location to work? Could you separate the two? In other words, if they have a couple of offices, could they be put in a different office? Who then gets moved? What is the cost? Because it might be farther for them to travel. And I know that's we're getting into a little bit of the details, but I just wanted to think that somebody might say, well, I could just put them somewhere else.
Well, you might be able to. It'll depend on facilities, your operation. The one thing I warn people about is be mindful about moving involuntarily the person coming forward with a complaint. Because if you say to the person with the complaint, you know what, why don't you go work in our Lewiston store instead of our Portland store, and then you won't have to deal with Jimmy. It may sound like a good idea, but that could rebound on you. And the person making the complaint could say, you know what, he got to stay. I made the complaint. And in fact, they immediately perceive it's retaliation. You know, no good deed goes unpunished. And that comes into play. So you really got to show some judgment in this situation. And if, in fact, somebody is moved, even though you haven't reached conclusions, it's more likely to be the person who is under investigation. So there's a lot of judgment and good discretion that has to be applied. Don't overdo administrative leave either. I sometimes see some situations where, you know, the person who's accused, we call them the respondent, that's what we usually say, but the person who's facing the allegations is put out, and they're really not of the severity or the nature that is necessary. And some stigma does go with administrative leave if it becomes known within an employer. If, you know, confidentiality should be adhered to, but people talk, let's face it. You know the phrase, where the smoke was fire?
Yes, absolutely.
People start to say that. I mentioned we represent a good number of school districts around Maine. And, you know, frankly, when a teacher or an educator gets accused of doing something inappropriate with a student, you have to take the precautionary measure often of placing the person on administrative leave. You do it with some real hesitation because you're concerned about the ramifications on that person, particularly if it proves to be false. Yet you have to maintain a safe environment, safe workplace, safe school. So
the other part of that is you never know what's going to hit the news media, right? The press. And that could have a quote-unquote damning effect on the person's reputation, true or not true. I mean, the fact is that when something like that hits the news media, and even when you've kept confidentiality, as you say, people talk, and we all know that reporters do their job, and doing their job is to get the scoop, and so that happens, and that can play a role in getting people to clam up or talk.
Certainly does. In many of our towns and cities around the state, there's a local paper, and particularly when we're dealing with public employers and public employees, it makes news. And so you have to be careful around that. The practice I have representing management makes me very understanding of the tough decisions that HR usually and management, sometimes in partnership, have to make on these matters. And there's no easy script. There's no formula.
Yeah, there's no one size fits all on this, is there?
There really isn't.
No.
And you know, what's the most key quality that somebody, you know, the HR professional has? It's really their judgment, and their judgment in these situations. And that may involve talking to others, getting some advice, weighing it. But of course, you know, time is always of the essence as well. So the stakes are high, and these are just not easy issues.
No. No, they're not. This is a serious but important part of the HR role, and has to be done right. You know, we're talking about how to handle this properly. A couple of the topics that I'd love to hear your thoughts on are, one, how much documentation do you really need to do? That said, who do you think really should be the investigator in this area? And then does it matter where the investigation takes place, how you set the stage?
Yeah, okay. I think the first part was the level of documentation.
Yes, documentation.
And you know, us lawyers, we certainly preach document, and for good reason. In this particular area of practice, you are certainly going to want to be keeping your notes and good notes, thorough notes, comprehensive notes as you walk through an investigation. And you keep those notes, and some of us still are dinosaurs and we handwrite them, and others are more, you know, typing everything now. What I like to see, and this is crucial in an investigation in my judgment, is that all of that information is then assembled into one comprehensive, thorough report. And that's the bedrock of any investigation. That will be the guide to what you did, what you found out, and what your conclusions were. And in fact, I get this question quite a bit when I present, well, what about all my notes? And I say, you can do what you want. Some people keep every single piece of paper. Others might take notes in the moment, type it all up, put it into a report, and get rid of the underlying notes and drafts. And that's not destroying evidence or doing anything untoward. It may be just the practice you have. And I actually like that particular practice. The report itself will be, you know, the most important document, as I said. It will include all the witness interviews. That's what you're going to keep, and you're going to keep for a long time. It may not go in an employee's personnel file, probably won't, but you want to make sure you have investigation files or a place for that where it is certainly maintained. And you talked about the place, I think, didn't you?
Dave? Yeah, the location where you think that this should it be on site, should it be off site, should it be in a neutral zone.
Yeah, if one is able to do it in a place that's not highly visible for other coworkers, namely in another location, in my view, a lot better. I work with one company that has a lot of retail stores, and I've been called upon to go to stores and conduct investigations. You worked in retail, if I remember correctly.
Sure did.
And retail offices are like shoeboxes at the back of the store, or they sometimes are surrounded by shoeboxes. And it's so much better to try to find an off-site location. And the reason is, you know, the obvious ones are privacy, confidentiality, and having the person feel comfortable. You want the people to feel as comfortable as possible. It's a high-stress moment for those who are engaged in it. And then the room itself, I mean, I think the most fundamental issue about, you know, where you do it is always have the person that you're interviewing, have them be the one near the door. Have them feel that, you know, they have a means of egress if they want it. You don't want them to turn around and say, you know, I was unlawfully detained, I was under duress, you know, you had me cornered, you sat too close to me. You just don't want to deal with any of those issues. So these are all, you know, good practices, but ones that you want to think about, plan. A good investigation, you plan it. You don't just walk into it. And there was a third question.
Well, the third question was who? Who investigates? Is it the HR professional? Is it a trained investigator? Is it, you know, do you go third party? Do you do internal? I mean, great question, right?
It is. And, you know, it's kind of, you've got listeners out there probably from a whole variety of organizations in size and resources. So the big organizations here in Maine may have the internal investigator. And that's the person who has the skills and the training and the experience to do it. And, you know, I'm a big believer and supporter that if you have that resource, use that resource. If you don't, and most employers here in Maine don't have that resource, then I think you want to be strategic as an organization and identify the person who's going to have that responsibility, and maybe there's more than one, and ensure that they have some training, because you can't just walk into this. Probably most investigators here in Maine who are doing this for their employers are likely self-taught. And I mean this with all the respect that I have for people in this field, but there's a lot of people who struggle to do it because they didn't go to school, they didn't take the job thinking I'll be an investigator. And then they find that that's part of their role. But it really is something that's quite challenging. And so if you have someone in your organization who's doing investigations, I really do recommend that they have some training, because if you end up in a lawsuit, the investigation often becomes the focus of the lawsuit. And the person who's challenging the outcome of the investigation will try to tear down the investigation to show that it was flawed, biased, all those things. And one way you do that is you go after the investigator and you look at the investigator's background and their resume and their experience. And you like to point out to the jury, the investigator for the Maine Human Rights Commission, whoever else it is, this person is doing this really important task and they've not had one iota of training. And no wonder they made such a mess up of it. That would be the argument. You may find that the sensitivity or the complexity of the issue require you to go outside. There are people in Maine who do investigations. I get called in to do investigations, not necessarily for my client. I represent the clients, but for other organizations who have an issue and say, we need to bring someone from the outside to come in and take a look at it. And you know, I've gone into police departments and other employers and and done, you know, an outsider's investigation. And the benefit that I have then is I don't have a dog in the fight. I come in, I don't know the characters, and that does allow you to have more objectivity. So it's always about finding the truth.
Well, I think you're right, and I think using sometimes a third party allows an organization to have an out in terms of, especially it is the top dog or top performer, then there are no prejudging. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking to Peter Lowe, and he's an employment attorney with Brown and Isaacson. We're having a great discussion on investigations, and we will be right back. News Talk WLOB.
Are you frustrated with medical care today? Does it make you angry that your doctor spends more time looking at the computer screen than at you? Does it seem like your doctor is out the door in 5 minutes? There is a better alternative. At Champy Family Practice, Dr. Michael Champy and his dedicated staff make taking care of patients their priority. They are a cash-friendly direct pay practice, which is the perfect option for people with no insurance, high deductibles, and health savings accounts. Unlike other practices, they post their prices in the office and even online. Get modern medical care delivered the old-fashioned way. For more information, call ChampyFamilyPractice.com. That's C-I-A-M-P-I. Or call 774-1222. Champy Family Practice is located at 380 Lincoln Street in South Portland. Champy Family Practice. Continuing a tradition of medical excellence in Greater Portland since 1959.
And we're back, and you're listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we're talking with Peter Lowe, Brown and Isaacson, employment attorney, and actually a pretty darn good friend. I do have to say that, Peter. You and I, we have so much fun out there speaking to HR groups all across the country. So, and I appreciate that and all the work you do.
Well, thank you. I do, too. We certainly get around to different audiences, and it's always fun to work with you. You have a healthy sense of humor that comes along with it, and you gotta have a good time.
Yeah, so we do. We do have a good time. Matter of fact, you know, I've been telling people that, you know, people may not know that Peter and I speak on the topic of medical marijuana, and with the state of New Hampshire now having just passed the medical marijuana law, we're beginning to gear up for some potential seminars in New Hampshire. And I will tell the audience, currently the favorite seminar topic. Program title is Live High or Die. So I just want to say it out there. I do know that New Hampshire has also been a big topic, and I know I've gotten off topic, but I just had to bring that up, Peter. You know me.
It's catching. You know I'm legendary for going off on a tangent. You know? You.
So, I did. I did it. I went off instead of you. That's amazing. Well, let's recap a little. We've talked a little about somebody's brought, in this case, a harassment complaint forward. The HR professional, the manager, have been provided that information and have told the individual what the process would be. They are now in the state of putting together the investigation. They've selected how they're going to do it. They've selected where it's going to be done. They've selected the process and how it's going to be handled. Now let's talk about the strategies for keeping the investigation on track. Who do you tell about the investigation? How do you make sure that the confidentiality is kept? How do you set up for the interview? Just some of the stages here that set the stage for going in, and then certainly we'll get into the investigation itself.
Yeah, to be fair on this, you know, when you take somebody else's wisdom, you want to give credit, and some of the information I'm going to share with you and have already, I've learned from one of my clients and colleagues and friends. His name is Toby Tyner, and he's an internal investigator. Has taught me a great deal. I'm stealing some of his ideas, and I know he won't mind that. One of the things that I know he likes to do and other investigators like to do is find out about the person you're going to talk to. Take a look at their personnel file. So maybe talk to the supervisor, talk to somebody else And that's just, it's a preliminary getting a picture. You're not doing formal witness interviews at that point. And the issue that obviously presents itself today is going onto Google, doing a search, looking at some social media. And I'll have people debate this and say, do you really want to do that? And all that stuff you can find out. I can happily have that debate. At this point, I'll make this simple and say, my advice is, as long as you respect privacy, you don't do anything underhand, you may learn information out there. And one example of that was shared with me was, you might find out that the person you're going to meet with, that their passion is baseball or tapestry or whatever it is. And why does that count? Because you might be able to connect right at the beginning and say, hey, you know, I understand you love baseball, I do too, or whatever it is. They don't need to know, you know, oh, I looked on social media, or I got it from the supervisor, but it's that initial point of connection. And that's important, I think, because once you relax people, you're going to get more information. So there's information that you might gather just to better equip yourself. Who else do you tell you're doing the investigation? The answer is only those with a need to know. That might be quite a narrow group. The supervisor or the manager in the area may need to know about it. That answer I gave earlier is a judgment on this, and it is a judgment of who's in that need-to-know circle. So those are some of the steps that I would suggest.
Sure. No, and I think that's true. I think all those things are part of what need to be thought of prior to going in. So let's set the stage. You now have gone in, and you have the accused, if you want to put it, and I think you said respondent there, and you're sitting down for that interview. Tell me some of the best practices for discovering the truth or getting to the truth of what's going on with this individual.
There really are some different techniques and some different styles that people have. I'm just going to share my opinion and experience about what I've seen that works, not to say some of the others don't work. I like to focus on why we're here, and we're here to find the truth. How are we going to find the truth? I think we have the best chance of finding the truth by being respectful, by being fair, by being honest. You know, I talked about some of the connection issues, first of all, with this is the interview with the accused. I think you want to try to have that connection. You want to be very clear and honest with the person about why we're here. There are some interviewing techniques that don't do that. In fact, they do the contrary. They leave the person sitting there, you know, really wondering what the heck's going on. And there's a theory, and it has a name, that's one way of doing it. I don't like that. I don't like that for the workplace. I think it fundamentally doesn't reflect the values of my client. I think that what you want to do as well then is start with the general. Start with the higher level. So if you're doing an investigation into a harassment issue, you don't say, hi, my name is Peter, nice to meet you. Have you ever harassed Jane?
Yeah, well, that would sure cut to the chase, Peter.
Yeah, but you know, some people have their list of questions, and you know, let's face it, it's damn awkward stuff often, and they just want to get it done. You know, they didn't want to do the interview, but let's just get to the point. That's almost invariably going to lead to the other person getting very defensive quickly, and you're not going to get to the truth, or not easily going to get to the truth. So you start at the high level. I want to talk. I want to get your side of it. And then, ultimately, you want to get to the specific. So if you have allegations that somebody made a crude sexual comment, that they touched somebody in an inappropriate place, you know, those types of allegations, sometimes, you know it, I know it, gets pretty graphic. It gets really graphic at times. The good investigator has ultimately to get to that point and be able to ask those really tough questions. And if you're going to rely on the allegations and conclude that the person either did those things or didn't, be sure that you ask them about them. That sounds really obvious, but sometimes I get investigation reports, and the most sensitive, graphic, obscene at times, allegation never been asked about. And you know, I know this is sort of too embarrassing, it's too awkward, and the person never got to that. those are some thoughts that I have for taking an approach that will ultimately get you the facts, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it really is about getting to the bottom line, right? I mean, you know, this is never comfortable for anyone. Even investigators, and I've talked to a number, as I know you have, it's never fun. It's really about getting to the fact, getting to the bottom line, and trying to solve a puzzle, trying to solve a problem that could affect the bottom line of an organization, affect the morale of an organization, and affect possible, you know, reputations. I mean, that's what I see this really being about.
Yeah, absolutely. And although you may be investigating some quite serious allegations, you, as much as possible, don't want the person who you're investigating to feel judged. The one phrase that I know I've heard folks use and seen in reports is the distinction between the behavior and the person. So if someone is engaged in theft, that's a bad act. Sometimes good people make bad decisions. Investigator at some point in the investigation may say that. Say, you know, I have to talk to you about this issue of theft, and the person will say, you think I'm a bad person. No, I'm really not here judging you as a person. I want to deal with the facts. And I know that good people can make bad choices. Things are going on in their lives, other circumstances, pressures. You know, that's an approach, again, it's very consistent with being fair, having a connection. You're not diminishing the seriousness of the conduct, but you're putting it in a context. We're all humans.
Absolutely.
We're all flawed. We all make mistakes. But the imbalance that may be perceived between the person who's investigating and this person who feels cornered and accused can be very, very great. And you're looking to try to dissipate some of those feelings, but still get to the truth. There may be times where you have to press and you use your judgment again. There may be a time where someone's denied something and you have to say, you need to know I've spoken to four other people who all describe this differently and say that you did say X, Y, Z. I need you to think about that and tell me whether all of those four people are in fact liars. Now that's a more blunt question. That's not warm and fuzzy. And that's not a kumbaya moment. But it can be a pretty darn effective one. And the person may come back and say, no, they're not liars. And, you know, you've really made inroads to determine what the facts are. The person may say they are liars. That's going to be a material answer, too. So,
right. You just never know where it's going to go. But as long as it's done the right way, it's key. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Peter Lowe, attorney at Brown and Isaacson. And we're talking about investigations. And we will be right back on News Talk WLOB. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And we are talking with Peter Lowe, employment attorney with Brown and Isaacson in Lewiston, Maine. We're talking about investigations, and we've kind of gone through, Peter, the whole process. We've taken them through the complaint. We've taken it through the preparation. We just recently talked about the investigation itself, taken down. Did I just say self? What was that, Debbie?
We're going to cut that and
cut
redo.
Cut that a little
okay.
bit. Wow. No. We've taken it through the investigation itself. We've now got to the point of you're done the interview. You've taken the information. You've written it all down. You've talked to all of the people that you need to talk to. And now is the moment of truth. So, Peter, how do you assess someone's credibility? Because really, at the end of the day, that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah, you're right, David. Often is. You know, there are some cases where people admit to misconduct. Those are the easier cases. You capture on videotape or things like that. But quite often it can be the so-called he said, she said. And there can be a tendency, an understandable one, to say, ah, one says one says the other, we can't do anything. Those who've heard me on this before, it's a sort of pet peeve of mine, and I say, no, you've got to. You've got to establish credibility if you can. But maybe sometimes you can't. But when I say to clients, usually when they're in this quandary, is who do you believe? And nearly always they do answer that and tell me who they believe. And then I say why, and we flesh it out. So very quick sort of checkpoints on what do you do to establish credibility? Well, you know, one of the things you do is what we do as humans, we make observations. We can look at and see how they responded during the interview. Were they agitated when you asked the key questions? Did they avert eye contact? Were they sweating copiously? Are those the conclusive issues? No. They're part of a mix in establishing credibility. You look and see, well, if this is a he said, she said, did she tell other people about this? When did she tell them? What did she tell them? Has she consistently told the same story? Has he consistently told the same story? If one has, one hasn't, there's a strike for one and against the other. I like to also suggest in the he said, she said, when there's no eyewitnesses, you know, eyewitnesses are crucial, they can tip the balance on credibility, but let's say there are none. I say, let's talk to somebody else in the workplace who doesn't have a dog in this fight. What I call sort of the honest broker, the person who will tell you as it is. You find that person and you talk to them and you'll learn some information sometimes about these two folks. You're not going to say to them, well, who should I believe? But you're asking them questions and interviewing them. What's the motive? This is a crucial question, I think. What's the motive for the person to make all of this up? What's their motive to lie? A really important question. Details count. If someone has a very detailed account of what happened, doesn't always mean they're telling the truth, but it can be a sign of truth-telling. So those are just some of the things that I like to consider, weigh, evaluate in determining credibility for the topic, but that's my summary.
No, I think, I mean, at the end of the day, it is exactly that. You're going to have to make a decision on who you believe. And, you know, it's not like in the game of football when you have two penalties, one from each team. You just say, oh, nothing changes. You just go from here. It really is about having to make a honest, appropriate decision, and that's why I think it's important at times to really determine if you need third-party counsel or advice, because these are not easy decisions. Peter, you know, one thing, if you could just, as we're about ready to wrap up here, about another minute or two on the show, some common mistakes you can think of that people make when they're doing this, the investigations are?
Yeah, number one we talked about, of course, is not investigating, but once you get the investigation underway. One thing I find that people do sometimes is that they miss a key witness. And there's somebody who did witness, you know, an altercation or alleged harassment. And I say, why haven't you spoken to that person? Oh, sometimes we overlooked it. Other times they say, well, he's really going to be reliable or fair or whatever else it is. I say, nope, you can't do that. Another common mistake is I see that people want to get this over done too quickly. There's sort of a rush. I understand that, but it doesn't lead to good outcomes. You've got to sort of hit the pause button and not do it too quickly. You've got to be thorough. The reports sometimes are really hard to follow, the reports that are written. And I think the guide is write this report so that an outsider, like myself or anybody else, can read it and know what was claimed, what you did, who you spoke to, what your conclusions are. And so it reads like a little short story. Don't assume that the person knows all about your workplace. So those things are very important.
Sure. No, I think those are key critical areas. The last question I have for you, Peter, as we wrap it up is, how do you leave it now? Once you've made a decision, how do you leave it with the person who has lodged the complaint and maybe the person who was accused, assuming that either party were right or wrong?
Yeah. Crucial that you get back to both. Sounds obvious, but sometimes, particularly the person who's come forward, doesn't hear back because there's a notion it's cloaked in confidentiality. I can't tell them. You need to sit down with the complainant, the person who made the complaint. Tell them you've done your investigation. Tell them at high level what your conclusions are. Tell them at a very high level, if necessary, that you've taken corrective action while respecting confidentiality, of course. And tell them that they're protected from non-retaliation. Put that all into a document. One page, it can get done in one page. That'll be one of the most valuable documents you prepare. Sit down with the person who's accused, and the script will vary greatly on your finding. If it's discipline, you're going to be sitting down with discipline. Perhaps termination, perhaps saying, we looked into it, we didn't conclude that these things happened, but you want that person to fully understand as well. So those are crucial communications. Sometimes there's others that you need to loop back with a high level as well. Documenting those discussions, and as I said, in the case of talking to the complainant, giving him or her a letter or memo that summarizes is very, very valuable.
Peter, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I think you provided a great overview of how to properly handle and execute an investigation in the workplace. I want to thank you again for being on the show today, and look forward to seeing you soon.
My pleasure. And Anderson Cooper, better watch out, because you're getting pretty good at this nowadays.
I'm having fun. This is, you gotta love what you do, and gosh, I do like doing this. And
terrific.
All right, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, a News Talk WLOB. And now your HR Tip of the Week. 9 Essential Skills for Human Resource Management. This is by Denise Rand, and she is on TrendHR.com. There are 9 areas in which HR professionals assess candidates against a list of key skills and personal characteristics needed for the job. Here are what the 9 are. Organization, multitasking, dealing with gray issues, negotiation, communication, being discreet and ethical, being able to have a dual focus, conflict management and problem solving, and being able to deal effectively with change management. That's your HR Tip of the Week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be speaking with 2 great guests. First, Cecil Hobbs. He is the Senior Vice President for Marketing and Business Development for Activate Networks. He's going to be talking about how HR can use company network information to provide high potential identification, succession planning, performance, and collaboration. Then we're going to be speaking with David Martinez. He is a manager and tax accountant with Baker Newman Noyes, an accounting and consulting firm in the Northeast. David is going to be talking about white glove treatment for corporate executives. These services can be contracted by an individual or can be retained by a company as an employee benefit with the aim towards recruiting and retaining top talent. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.